Leandro's baby girl died in January after Feast of the Kings, and no one here knew. Cruz told Mother today. He was gone 3 weeks, not because he was angry with his sergente, but to bury a child. The two small grapefruit heads in church, only one now. Cruz had a fight with Mother because what Don Enrique pays is not enough for feeding a chicken. She said Leandro's wife couldn't get her milk and the baby died. How can he go home to a family with nothing to eat, then come to this house to make 100 tamales? He behaves as if he had no dead children. The real Leandro never comes here. He only pretends. 9 March. Today, the lacuna is gone. Directly below the knob in the cliff, nothing. If it is there, then buried below too much ocean. The grass hummock on the cliff face is very low to the water now, or rather, the sea is higher. Don Enrique is away in the Huasteca, and Mother has taken up kitchen knives. She waved one around this morning, not to chop onions, but to show she means business about keeping her secrets. Not just the brujo, but also Mr. P.T. Cash. So, no mention here about another surprising visit from him while the master was away. Anyway, Mother is too lazy to lift up a mattress and find this little book. 13 March. The lacuna came back. In the afternoon, the rock opened its mouth and swallowed the boy down its gullet. But it was hard to swim. The water was rushing out. It was the same as before, lungs bursting, turning back too soon. Leandro's brother whispering, "Come live with me here." But a brain hungry for oxygen loses courage and wants air. Tomorrow will be the day. Last Will and Testament. Let it be known, if HWS drowns in the cave, he leaves nothing to anyone. His earthly possessions are stolen things. Pocket watch. This book. 1 year of good luck. He leaves his body for the fishes to eat. He leaves Leandro to wonder where he has gone. He leaves Mother and Mr. Produce the Cash to enjoy the company of the devil. Dios habla por el que calla. 14 March. The cave has bones inside. Bones of humans. Things on the other side. This is how it feels when you are nearly drowned. The brain pounds like a pulse in red and black. The salt water burns your eyes, and you nearly go blind following the light until you come to the air, breathing. At the end of the tunnel, the cave opens up to light, a small saltwater pool in the jungle. Almost perfectly round, as big across as this bedchamber, with sky straight up, dappled and bright through the branches. Amate trees stood in a circle around the waterhole, like curious men, gaping because a boy from another world had suddenly arrived in their pool. The pombo trees squatted for a close look, with their knobbly wooden knees poking up out of the water. A tiger heron stood one-legged on a rock, cocking an unfriendly eye at the intruder. San Juan Pescadero, the kingfisher, zipped back and forth between two perches, crying, "Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!" Piles of stone blocks lay in a jumble around the edges of the pool, a broken-down something made of coral rock. Vines scrambled all over the ruin, their roots curling down through it like fingers in sand. It was a temple or something else very ancient. The light through the trees was shadowy at midday, but the water was clear. Belly dragged up on a flat stone, sitting at the edge looking back in, it was plain to see the bottom of the cave dropped down to make a sort of room down there, huge and deep. Stones were piled like a sand castle underwater, with bits of shining things mixed into the pile. maybe yellow leaves or gold coins. It was like coming up inside a storybook, an ancient temple in the forest, and a pirate's treasure below. The treasure was mostly shells and broken pottery covered with sea moss, mostly too deep to dive down and reach. It took hours to explore everything. Some of the broken blocks of the ruin had designs carved on them, a script of lines and circles, or perhaps the portraits of gods. One looked like a skeleton, its arms flung open, the skull smiling wide. A water snake slipped off a rock and made a sliding S shape across the top of the water. The jungle vines were tangled like fishing nets. It was the type of forest with a watery floor and no good way to walk out of there. And no good way to swim back out of that cave, either. No way back from this story, it seemed. Nothing left to do but slide like a turtle into the pool, sink down, and sit on slime-covered rocks and the treasure of ancient times. That is where the bones were. Leg bones wedged in the rocks. It made for such a shock, it was hard to breathe after seeing them. Floating in the pool was also not very easy because now the tide pulled downward, dropping lower and sucking against the stones around the edge of the hole, hissing a song of drowning. Ahogarse, ahogarse. The ocean pulled hard, dragging a coward explorer back from the secret place, sucking him out through the tunnel and spitting him into the open sea. Out there again, gasping, it was plain that the tide had turned and gone out. Now it was extremely low. Coral knobs poked out like heads. A great round moon hung on the eastern horizon, just coming out of the sea, white as an oyster. Then it seemed the bones and temple could not have been real, and this cave would vanish again. Only the moon was real, as big and whole as breathing. A book in Don Enrique's library says the pagans of old built their castles on this island. Not as tall as the great pyramids of the Azteca, but small stepped temples with platforms for sacrifice. They carved pictures of their gods, which were many in number. The book said the same things Leandro says, that the ancients watched light and signs to tell them when to plant corn, when to get married. But it also said more terrible things. They made sacrifices by throwing gold and sometimes girls, alive, into waterholes in the forest. The cave must be that kind of hole, a cenote, because of the bones. The book was written by a priest. Not very good, but interesting at some parts. Hernán Cortés sent an expeditionary force to destroy the pagan city here and build the cathedral in town. If the ruin in the jungle is really part of that ancient city, then for certain the cenote has gold and treasure in its depths, along with the bones of unlucky girls. Leandro might know something about it, but can't be asked. There is no trusting his allegiance. He might tell Mother. So he will never know about going inside the Lacuna. March 24. First, the cave wasn't there today. Or so it seemed. But really it was, nearly 2 meters down from the surface, buried by tide, with a strong current flowing out of it. The last time, it was morning when the current inside the cave pulled inward toward the jungle hole. During the hours of exploring, the tide must have turned, so at evening it was easy to swim out. The moon was just rising then. The tides are the cause. The time to go in is just before the tide turns. Otherwise, more bones on that pile. 25 March. The tide was wrong completely. The current flowed out of the cave all day. On the day of the full moon, everything was right. Don Enrique says a full moon pulls up the highest tides of the month at midday and midnight, and it pulls them down to their lowest ebb when it is rising or setting. So says a man in a frock coat and breeches who, if he tried to row a boat, would fall out instantly and drown. But Leandro said the same thing about the moon and high tide, so it might be true. How can you know if the moon is going toward full or disappearing? This evening, the moon was half, and Leandro said it's dying away. You can tell because it's shaped like the letter C, not curved forward like D. He says when the moon is D, like Dios, it is growing to fill God's sky. When dying away, it is C, like Cristo on the cross. So, no good tides again for many days. 12 April. Today was the full moon, perfect tide, and the bad luck of slicing the end of a finger with the kitchen knife. Blood everywhere, even in the masa, turning it pink. It had to be thrown out. Oh, no, let's serve it to Don Enrique and Mother, a clayuda of her son's blood, like the Azteca sacrifices to their gods. Leandro said, pray God forgives you for such talk. Get busy and make more masa. Tonight the moon rose, the beach was quiet, and no one swam into the lacuna. The three musketeers would have done it, diving in with scabbards in their teeth, not bandages on their fingers. But they were three, all for one and one for all. Tonight a shadow passed across the moon. Don Enrique says an eclipse, but Leandro says it is El Dios and El Cristo putting their heads together, crying over everything that happens down here. 2 May. Birthday of Santa Rita de Casia. Mother needed cigarettes, but there wasn't any market today because of the fiesta. All the women went to the procession in long ruffled skirts, their hair braided with ribbons and flowers. Boys carrying beeswax candles as tall as men. The old woman who sells nopal in the market was at the front, dressed like a wrinkled bride. Her old groom shuffled beside, holding her arm. Leandro says they couldn't have this fiesta last year because of the silence against the church, but that Santa Rita de Casia is not really a saint, but a woman god. Nothing is ever what they say, and no one holy 100%. 12 May. Perfect tide today. Into the cave and back out. The water pushed all the way in to touch those bones again. Tomorrow the tide should be almost perfect again. But only a few more days this month to look for the treasure hidden from Hernan Cortes. 13 May. Mother says tonight, in just a few hours we leave on the ferry. It isn't possible just to go away from here, but she said, oh, yes, it is. Leave everything. Tell no one, she said. Don Enrique will be furious. Not even Cruz can know. Don't pack anything from your room yet because she would notice. Wait till it's almost time. Take only what fits in one rucksack. Two books only. Not those huaraches. Don't be ridiculous. Your good shoes. She said, bueno, very fine. If you want to stay here, stay. On this stupid island, so far from everything, you have to yell three times before even Jesus Cristo can hear you. I will happily go without you and light a candle for you in the Catedral Nacional when I get there, because when Enrique finds out, he'll kill you instead of me. Mr. Produce the Cash is meeting us on the mainland. You will not say one word to Leandro, not one word, mister. Dear Leandro, here is the note you won't read because you can't read. The pocket watch is in the jar in the cabinet. with the clay Piltzin Tecutli. It's a gift to find next year when you have to make the rosca with no sergente to help mix the flour. The watch is gold. Maybe you can take it to Monte Piedad and get money for your family. Or keep it to remind you of the pest who is gone. Mexico City, 1930, initialed VB. 11 June. La luna de junio, first full moon in June, a day to dive for treasure. But the nearest thing to ocean here is the rot fish smell on Saturdays after all the wives on the alley cooked fish the day before, and their garbage is waiting for the slop cart man. The ocean is the last dream in the morning before noise from the street comes in. Motor cars, police on horses, the tide goes out. The prisoner awakes on a new island, an apartment above a bakery shop. Mother says a casa chica means probably his wife knows about her, but doesn't mind because a small house doesn't cost too much. The maid doesn't even sleep here, no room. The water closet and gas cooking eye are in the same room. The main kitchen is downstairs in the bakery, passed through from the street with a key. No library and no garden here, in a city that stinks of buses. Mother thinks it is all wonderful and reminds her of childhood, even though that was a long time ago and not this city. And if it was so wonderful, why did she never go back to see her father and mother until dead? Quit your moping, mister. Finally, we're off that island where nothing was ever going to happen. Here, you don't have to yell three times before Jesus Cristo can hear you. Probably because after the second yell, Jesus would look down in time to see you get coshed by a trolley. But, she says, God has a swell house here, the biggest cathedral in the world, one of the high marks of the Distrito Federal. So far, we've seen only one high mark, La Flor, the shop where Mr. Produce the Cash and his friends go for coffee. We went there alone, in defiance of orders. His businessman friends don't yet know about his new enterprise, the secret kept in a small box, the Casa Chica. The lid of the box is Mother's hush money, which she says is not very much, so probably she will not be very quiet. She needed to go to La Flor to have a look-see at how they dress here, so she won't be a low-lid dumb Dora like people on that island. On the streets you can see which men are farmers who've come to the city for the day. White trousers rolled to the knees. The men taking coffee at La Flor were all black trouser men. The ladies wore cloche hats and smart, short dresses like mother's, but with black stockings for modesty. The waitresses had white aprons and eyes wide with fright. This city is like Washington, and it isn't. It's difficult to remember real places from the book places. The patio had giant fern trees like the forest in Journey to the Center of the Earth, and very good chocolate. Cookies called cat's tongues. The cats meow, Mother said, but really the cats not meow. Our alley has so many, with a slingshot you could get a good supply of tongues. Mother was in a jolly mood and finally agreed to stop at the stationer's on the way home for a new notebook. She pouted. You love that little book more than me. You'll go in your room and forget me. But just now she came in and said, You poor thing. You're like a fish that needed water. I didn't even know. Today, the cathedral. It took all morning to reach the central plaza, the Zócalo, two buses and then a trolley to get there from the outside edge of the Distrito Federal. The Casa Chica is located in an unfashionable neighborhood south of the bullfighting plaza on a dirt alley that runs into Insurgentes. According to Mother, we reside halfway between the capital of Mexico and Tierra del Fuego, South America. The Zócalo is a huge square with palm trees like parasols. Facing one side is the long Palacio Nacional of pink stone with small windows all the way down it like holes in a flute. The brick streets leading into the Zócalo are narrow as animal burrows in tall grass, the buildings close on both sides, as far as you can see. Downstairs are shops, and people live above. You can see the women leaning on their elbows on the iron balconies watching everything below. Bicycle carts, horses, and automobiles, lines of them, sometimes going both ways in the same street. The cathedral is immense, as promised, with gigantic wooden doors that look as if they could shut you out for good. The front is all warbly with carvings. The ship of the church sailing over one door looked like a Spanish galleon, and over the other, Jesus is handing over the keys to the kingdom. He has the same worried look the bakery shop man had when giving Mother the key to come through his shop to our apartment upstairs. Mr. Produce the Cash owns the building. Inside the cathedral, you have to pass the great altar of Perdón, all golden with angels flying about. The black Christ of the Venom hangs there dead in his black skirt, surrounded by little balconies, maybe for the angels to land on when they get tired. It was such a monument of accusation, even Mother had to bow her head a little as she crept past it, sins dripping from her shoes as we walked around the nave, leaving invisible puddles on the clean tiles. Perhaps God said her name was Mud. He would have to yell that more than 3 times for her to hear. Around the back outside the church was a little museum. A man there told us the cathedral was built by Spaniards right on top of the great temple of the Azteca. They did it on purpose so the Azteca would give up hope of being saved by their own gods. Just a few pieces of temple left. The man said the Azteca came to this place in ancient times after wandering many hundred years looking for a true home. When they got here, they saw an eagle sitting on a cactus, eating a snake, and that was their sign. A good enough reason to call a place home, better than all of Mother's up to now. The best artifact was the calendar of the ancients, a great carved piece of stone as big as a kitchen, circular, bolted to the wall like a giant clock. In the center was an angry face looking out, as if he'd come through that stone from some other place to have a look at us, and not very pleased about it. He stuck out his sharp tongue, and in taloned hands he held up 2 human hearts. Around him, smiling jaguars danced in a circle of endless time. It might be the calendar Leandro knew about. He would be happy to know the Spaniards decided to keep it when they bashed up everything else. But Leandro can't read a letter, so there is no use writing him anything about it. Mr. P.T. Cash is to come on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Mother could put a sign on her door like the bakery shop downstairs. They discuss the boy's future. P.T. says the preparatoria in September, but Mother says no, he can't get in there. It's supposed to be difficult, with Latin, physics, and things of that kind. What will they make of a boy who has only attended the school of Jules Verne and the Three Musketeers for 5 years? Her idea is a little school organized by nuns. But P.T. Cash says she is a dreamer. The revolution did away with those when the priests fled Mexico. If they know what's good for them, he said, those schoolteacher nuns got married. Mother insists she saw a school on Avenida Puig, south of here. But preparatoria is free, and a Catholica school would cost money, if one could be found. We will see who wins, Mr. Produce the Cash or Miss No Cash Whatever. 24 June. St. John's Day. All the church bells ringing on a Tuesday. The maid says it's a signal for the lepers to bathe. Today is the only day of the year they are allowed to touch water. No wonder they smell as they do. On the way back from the Colonia Roma dress shop today, it started to rain like pitchforks, and we bought paper hats from the newspaper boys. When it rains, they give up on shouting about the new bureaucratic plan and fold it up into something useful. Then we lost the way home, and Mother laughed, her hair stuck like little black ribbons to her face, for once happy, for no reason. Standing under an awning to hide from the rain, we noticed it was a shop of books and went inside. It was fantastic. Every sort of book, including medical ones, the human eye drawn in cross-section, and reproductive organs. Mother sighed for the slim chances of gaining entrance to the no-cost preparatoria. She told the shopkeeper she needed something to put her boy on the right track, and he showed her the section of very old, worn-out ones. Then took pity on Mother and said if we brought them back later, he would return most of the price. Huzzah! Something new to read. For your birthday, she said, because it passed almost a week ago and she was sorry for not celebrating. So pick out something for turning 14, she said, but still no adventure novels. Pick something serious, history, for example, and no Pancho Villa, mister. According to her, if he hasn't been dead 20 years, he isn't history. The Azteca are dead for hundreds, so we got two books about them. One is all of the letters written by Hernán Cortés to Queen Juana of Spain, who sent him off to conquer Mexico. He sent back plenty of reports, starting each one with "Most lofty, powerful, and very Catholic Empress." The other one is by a bishop who lived among the pagans and drew pictures of them, even naked. More rain, a good day for reading. The Great Pyramid under the cathedral was built by King Ahuitzotl. Luckily, the Spaniards wrote buckets about the Azteca civilization before they blew it to buttons and used its stones for their churches. The pagans had priests and temple virgins and temples of limestone blocks ornamented on every face with stone serpents. They had gods for water, earth, night, fire, death, flowers, and corn. Also many for war, their favorite enterprise. The war god Mechitli was born from a holy virgin who lived at the temple. The bishop wrote how curious it was that just like our holy virgin, when she turned up expecting a baby, the Azteca priests wanted to stone her, but heard a voice saying, "Fear not, mother, thy honor is saved." Then the war god was born with green feathers on his head and a blue face. The mother must have had quite a fright that day, all round. Because of all that, they gave her a temple with a garden for birds, and for her son, a temple for human sacrifice. Its door was a serpent's mouth, a lacuna leading deep into the temple where a surprise waited for visitors. Towers were built from all their skulls. The priests walked about with their bodies blackened with the ashes of burnt scorpions. If only Mother had brought us here 500 years sooner. Every day it rains buckets. The alley is a river. Women do their washing in it. Then it dries up, flotsam everywhere. The maid says it's a law that everyone has to clean a section of the street, so we should pay her husband for that. Mother says no dice. If we have to huddle like pigeons upstairs, we aren't paying any damn street cleaner. Mother's room has a tiny balcony facing outward to the alley, and this room is opposite, facing a courtyard inside the block of buildings. The family across keeps a garden there, hidden from the street. The grandfather wears white cotton trousers rolled to his knees, tending squash vines and his pigeon house, a round brick tower with cubby holes around the top where his pigeons roost. The old man uses a broom to chase away parrots eating his flowers. When the moon is di como Dios, his pigeons cry all night. Cortés is an adventure story, better than the Three Musketeers. He was the first Spaniard to find this city, which was Tenochtitlan then, capital of the Azteca Empire. Somehow it was in a lake at that time. They had causeways crossing the water, wide enough for Cortés and his horsemen to ride abreast. He heard of the great city and sent messages first so the Azteca wouldn't kill him the minute he arrived. A good plan. King Moctezuma met him with 200 nobles all dressed in nice capes and gave Cortés a necklace made of gold prawns. Then they sat down to discuss the circumstances. Moctezuma explained that long ago their ancient lord went back to his native land where the sun rises, so they were expecting one of his descendants to come back any time and subject the people as his rightful vassals. Cortés had sent messages about being sent hither by a great king, so they thought he must be their natural lord. That was good luck for Cortés, who rejoiced and took leisure from the fatigues of his journey. Moctezuma gave him more gold things and one of his daughters. The Azteca in other cities were not so friendly to the Spaniards and killed them. One was a big troublemaker, Qualpopoca. Cortés demanded him brought in for punishment, and to be safe, decided to put Moctezuma in chains, but on a friendly basis. Qualpopoca arrived fuming, insisting he was a vassal of no great king from anywhere and hated all Spaniards. So he was burned alive in the public square. Mother is tired of hearing bits of the story. She says she is not a damn queen of Spain. Put the candle out before it falls on the bed and burns you alive. She says we can't keep the book, even if it is the best adventure ever. And a birthday present. It is too long to copy the whole story out, only the main parts. Cortés let Moctezuma go free again, and they were still friends, which seems strange. He showed Cortés the buildings and marketplaces, fine as any in Spain, and stone temples higher than the great church of Seville. Inside some, the walls were covered with the blood of human sacrifice. But the people had great culture and politeness of manners, with good government everywhere maintained, and stone pipes to bring water down from the mountains. Moctezuma had a grand palace and lattice houses where he kept every manner of bird, waterfowl to eagle. It took 300 men to look after them all. But really, Cortés wanted a tour of the gold mines. Playing dumb Dora, he told Moctezuma the land looked very fertile, so the great king should like to have a farm there, over the gold mine. They fixed it up with maize fields, a big house for his majesty, even a pond with ducks. Crafty Cortés. Next, the governor of Honduras grew very jealous and sent 80 musketeers over to Mexico, declaring he had the true authority of Spain to conquer and suborn the natives. Just when Cortés was having such a grand time, he had to go with all haste back to the port of Veracruz to defend his position, then rush straight back to save the men he'd left at Tenochtitlan. For the people there finally got wise to Cortés, and his name was Mud. The populace advanced upon his garrison, and they fought for their lives. King Moctezuma climbed a tower and shouted for everyone to stop, but he was struck in the head by a rock and died 3 days later. Cortez got out of that place by the skin of his neck. He had to leave behind almost all his golden shields, crests, and other such marvelous things as could not be described nor comprehended. That is what he wrote, but probably he was too embarrassed to describe or comprehend them, because 1/5 share of the booty was supposed to go to her extremely Catholic Majesty, the Queen. Almost the whole night reading and copying until the candle burned out. This morning, Mother said, "Stop being lazy and run to the market. We need coffee, cornmeal, and fruit, but really cigarettes." Mother could go for 1 year without food, but not 1 day without her lipsticks. The Piedad market had no cigarettes. The old women there were smoking cigarettes, but said they didn't have any because it's Friday. They said, "Try the one south of here, the Melchoro Campo market. Just walk south on Insurgentes to the next little town from here, Coyoacan. Take the lane called Francia. That market has everything." Mother is right about the city ending just south of where we live. It isn't South America, but the streets turn to dirt lanes, and it's like a village, with families living in wattle huts around dirt courtyards, children squatting in the mud, mothers making fires to cook tortillas. Grandmothers sit on blankets, weaving more blankets for other grandmothers to sit on. Between the houses, gardens of maize and beans. From the last bus stop after 2 maize fields is Coyoacan, as the women said, a market with everything. Cigarettes, piles of squash blossoms, green chiles, sugar cane, beans, green parrots in bamboo cages, a band of leprosos walking north toward the city for their morning begging, like skeletons with skin stretched over the bones and tatters of clothes hanging like flags of surrender, begging with whatever parts of hands they still had attached. The next thing to come along was an iguana as big as an alligator, strolling with a frown on its face and a collar on its neck. Attached to the collar, a long rope, and holding the rope, a man with no teeth, singing. "Señor, is it for sale?" "What isn't, young friend? Even I could be yours for a price."
"Your lizard, is it food or a pet?"
"Más vale ser comida de rico que perro de pobre," he said. "Better to be the food of a rich boy than the dog of a poor one." But today, there was only enough money for fruit and cigarettes. Anyway, the maid cries enough already, without having to cook a lizard for lunch. It took a long time to walk back, but Mother wasn't angry. She'd found a couple of dinchers in the pocket of her yellow dress.
Sunday is the worst day. Everyone else has family and a place to go. Even the bells from the churches have a conversation, all ringing at once. Our house is like an empty cigarette packet, lying around reminding you what's not in it. The maid, gone to Mass. Mr. Produce the cash to the wife and children. Mother rinses her girdles and step-ins, flings them on the rails of the balcony to dry, and finds herself with nothing left to live for. Sometimes, when there isn't anything in the house to eat, she says, "Okay, kiddo, it's dincher dinner." That means sharing her cigarettes so we won't be hungry. Today she pinched the Cortez book and hid it because she was lonely. "You just read your books and go 100 miles away. You ignore me." Well, you ignore me whenever Produce the Cash is here. Go find him. The door to her bedroom slammed, rattling its glass panes. Then opened again. She can't stay cooped. "A person could go blind from reading so much." Your eyes must be good, then.
You slaughter me, cheeky Charlie, and that notebook is giving me the heebie-jeebies. Stop it! Stop writing down everything I say!
E-V-E-R-Y-T-H-I-N-G S-H-E-S-A-Y-S. Finally, tonight, she had to give up Cortez in exchange for the cigarettes because she was going to die without them. The market in Coyoacan is not like the Zocalo downtown, where everything comes ready-made. The girls in blue shawls sit on blankets with stacks of maize they just broke from the field an hour before. While waiting for people to come, they shell off the kernels. If more time passes, they soak the corn in lime water, then grind it into wet nixtamal and pat it out. By day's end, all the corn is tortillas. Nixtamal is the only kind of flour they use here. Even our maid doesn't know how to make white flour bread. While the girls make tortillas, the boys cut bamboo from marshes by the road and weave it into bird cages. If no one comes to buy a cage, they will climb up trees and steal birds from their nests to put in the cages. You have to come before 10 in the morning if you want whole maize ears or an empty birdcage. By the end of the week, they will have made a world. And on the seventh day, rest, like God. The old lizard man comes every day. He and his creature look the same, with whitish scaly skin and wrinkled eyes. The man is called Cienfuegos, and his beast is named Manjar Blanco, creamed chicken. On the plaza near the Melchor Market, the palace of Cortez still stands. He ruled from there after conquering the Azteca. First it was the garrison where he gathered his musketeers and schemed to take over Tenochtitlan. A plaque on the square tells about it. This very place Cortez described in his third letter to the queen. How strange to read of a place in a book and then stand on it, listen to the birds sing, and spit on the cobbles if you want. Only it was on the shore of the lake then. The great city had dikes to hold back the waters, and sometimes the Aztecas removed stones from the dikes, causing floods to rush over Cortez and his men as they slept. They had to swim for their lives. 21 July. The question of school lurks. Exams for entering the preparatoria are a few weeks away. Tomorrow, we will go back to the bookshop for more improving texts. The letters of Cortez will be traded for something else, and it's no use tearing a fit to keep it. Tonight is the last chance to finish and copy out the good bits. The last siege of Tenochtitlan. Cortez tried to block the causeways across the lake and starve them out. But the people threw maize cakes at him and said, "We are in no want of food, and later, if we are, we shall eat you." He made his men build 13 ships in the desert and dig a canal to move them to the lake, so he could attack both by land and water, the final assault. He bore his ship straight into a fleet of canoes hurling darts and arrows. He wrote, "We chased them for 3 leagues, killing and drowning the enemy, the most extraordinary sight in the whole world." He mentioned to the queen how it pleased God to raise up their spirits and weaken those of the enemy. Also, the Spaniards had muskets. The people fought him as the bitterest of foes, including women. Cortez was dismayed by their refusal to submit. He wrote, "I was at pains to think in what way I could terrify them so as to bring them to knowledge of their sins and the damage we were in a position to do them." So he set fire to everything, even the wooden temples where Moctezuma kept his birds. He was much grieved to burn up the birds, he said. But since it was still more grievous to them, I determined to do it. The people uttered such yells and shrieks that it seemed as if the world was coming to an end. 22 July. The new book is nowhere near as good. Geographical Atlas of Mexico. The city of Mexico is 2.5 kilometers above sea level. In ancient times, it was different islands built on stone foundations in a salt lake connected by causeways. The Spaniards drained the lake with canals, but it is still a swamp. The old buildings all tilt. Some streets still run like canals when it rains. The motor cars are like ancient canoes, and the people flow from one island to another. And rulers still make grand buildings with paintings on the outside. The newspapers call them temples of the revolution. Modern people are just like ancient ones, only more numerous. August 4. A victory for Mother, being seen in the daylight with Mr. P.T. Cash. He took us in his automobile to have lunch at Sanborn's, downtown near the cathedral in the Casa Azulejos. The grand lunchroom at the center of the building has a glass ceiling so high that birds fluttered under it, indoors by accident. One wall was covered with a painting of a garden, peacocks and white columns. Mother said it portrayed Europe. Her cheeks were pink because of meeting the important friends. Waitresses in long striped skirts brought carts of rainbow-colored juices, pomegranate, pineapple, guayabana. The important friends paid no attention to the pretty juices, discussing the federal investment plan and why the revolution will fail. Mother wore her smartest silk chiffon, a blue helmet hat, and eardrops. Her son wore a dress coat too tight and short. Mr. P.T. Cash wore his Glenark Hart plaid suit and nervous expression, introducing Mother as his niece visiting for the year. The friends were oilmen with oiled hair and one old doctor named Villaseñor. His wife, a rock of ages, in high lace collar and pince-nez. All gringos except the doctor and wife. The oil man said the sooner the Mexican oil industry collapses, the better, so they can take it over and make it run straight. One told his theory about why America is forward and Mexico is backward. When the English arrived in the New World, he said, they saw no good use for Indians and killed them. But the Spaniards discovered a native populace long accustomed to serving masters, the Azteca. So the empire yoked these willing servants to its plows to create New Spain. He said that was their mistake, allowing native blood to mingle with their own to make a contaminated race. The doctor agreed, saying the mixed-race mestizos have made a mess of the government because they are smoldering cauldrons of conflicting heritages. He said, the mestizo is torn by his opposing racial impulses. His intellect dreams of high-minded social reforms, but his brute desires make him tear apart every advance his country manages to build. Do you understand this, young man? Yes, only, which half of the mestizo brain is the selfish brute, the Indian or the Spanish? Mother said her son intends to be a lawyer, causing everyone to laugh. But it wasn't a joke. Cortez and the governor of Honduras were tearing one another apart before they'd even got started. Cortez burned people and birds alive to be terrifying. The Azteca priests smeared their churches with blood, also to be terrifying. The oil man named Thompson told Mother she should make a military man of that one, not some snake of a lawyer. President Ortiz Rubio sends his two sons to the Gettysburg Academy in America, just the ticket. Mother asked the doctor's wife if there were any little schools left, run by the Catholic sisters. The Rock of Ages nearly started to cry, saying they are all gone due to the revolution. But they still have a place for the ones who aren't clever enough for the preparatoria. The government has let Acción Católica take over the schools for the deaf mutes, cretins, and children of bad character. Mrs. Doctor said the revolution has wrecked everyone's morals and turned the churches into newspaper offices or moving picture theaters. She told Mother they used to have laws to restrict things like gambling, concerts, divorce, and somersaulters. In the time of Porfirio, a person didn't have to see all that. Mother might quite like to see some somersaulters and divorce. Her favorite song is Anything Goes. But she put her hand on Mrs. Doctor's lace sleeve. As a helpless mother trying to raise a young boy alone, she needed advice. 13 August. Feast of St. Hippolytus and entrance exams at the preparatoria. It was a scorching, most terrible of all, the maths. Latin was a guessing game. Outside the window, noisy green parrots came all afternoon to tear apart a patch of yellow tube-shaped flowers. 25 August. Today begins the year of all suffering at the School of Cretins, Deaf Mutes, and Boys of Bad Character on Avenida Puig. The classroom is like a prison hall full of writhing convicts, its iron-barred windows set high along one wall. Small boys and monkeys for pupils. No one else there could be 14 or anything near it. They're the size of baboons. The Holy Virgin feels very sorry, but remains outside on her cement pedestal in the small, tidy garden. She has sent her son Jesus in with the other wretches, and he can't flee either. He is pegged to his cross on the wall, dying all the day, rolling his eyes behind the back of Señora Bartolomé. Even he can't stand the look of her clay pipe legs and those shoes. She teaches one subject only, estricta moralidad. The tropical climate inclines young persons of Mexican heritage to moral laxity, she says. Señora Bartolomé, perdón, we are at an elevation of 2,300 meters above sea level here, so it isn't tropical, strictly speaking. The average monthly temperature ranges from 12 to 18 degrees centigrade. It's from the geographical atlas. Punished for insolence. Bad character accomplished the first day of term. Tomorrow, perhaps deaf-mute. After that, one could aspire to cretin. September 1. No reading in class. Señora Bartolomé says a book will distract from her lessons of hygiene, morality, and self-control. You'll sing a different song in the administrator's office. She hints it may contain Iron Maidens and the resting rack. After lunch, the older boys fall into sword fights, and smaller ones play at hawks and hens. If one pupil stilts out for the afternoon, subtracting from the bedlam, the señora could only be the happier. Mother doesn't notice either. Too busy fuming about P.T.'s big house with 19 maids in Colonia Juarez, which we will probably never see because of P.T.'s wife. Mother's big plans washed out, like flotsam in the alley after it rains. Saturday is the best day at the Melchor Ocampo market. One old cigarette seller named La Perla is boss of that place, telling the girls to tidy their flower stalls.
Wapo, ven aquí. Take this money and go buy me a pulque. I see you here every day. Novio, are you too good looking for the schoolroom?
Handsome. To an old woman with the face of a lizard. 13 September. P.T. Cash came today to the Casa Chica, but left early. Everyone in a foul mood, God included. The rain kept pouring until it seemed the whole sky would drain like a tide. First Mother cried, then drank tea like a foreigner, trying to drown her Mexican passions. He shouted that her head is in the clouds. He is a man, not a fountain of money. The PNR is falling apart, and everything he worked to build is running away like the water out in the streets. The American businesses will run across the border like Vasconcelos did. Mother knows this small house could fall at any moment, and we shall be beggars looking for scraps at the market, bathing on St. John's Day. 15 September. Independence Day, the town boiling with parades for the revolution. At school, the cretins performed in costume, traditional dances impaired by the absence of girls. The teachers made a patriotism banquet, rice in the colors of the flag, red and green salsa, cups of rice water, sugared almonds, a little of everything and of nothing quite enough. At the head of the table by the bowl of pomegranates, Senora Bartolome had put a note. Take only one. Our Lord Jesus is watching. A second note appeared at the foot of the table beside the sugared almonds. Take all you want. Jesus is looking at the pomegranates. The other boys laughed and spit rice water. The prank earned great approval and a whipping. But the administrator has a weak arm. Halfway through, he had to sit and rest, saying, "This squalid school, is there no better place for you?" 16 September. Stilted out of school before morning roll call. North on Avenida Puig and straight on past the Hospital for Lepers. Past the Plaza Santo Domingo, where the scribes write letters for the people who can't. Many blocks of multifamiliares with tiny balconies like ours, each building painted pink, blue, or ochre. The wooden trolleys run in straight lines, north to south, east to west. The Azteca built it this way, with the Templo Mayor the center of everything. The Spaniards couldn't change what's underneath. The Zocalo was crowded with men selling ices, women in long braids selling vegetables, charlatans selling miracles, the scent of copal, music from the organ grinders, a man selling carnitas, the hungry boys following him like dogs. Some preparatoria students put on a play in the street about Ortiz Rubio and Calles. The president was a puppet on strings, and old dictator Calles was his puppet master. The preparatoria students had also stilted out from school. The shortest way home was to walk by the Viga Canal, filled with floating newspaper pages and one dead dog swelled up like a yellow melon. 29 September. Today at the Melchor Market, a fantastical sight. A servant girl with a birdcage on her back, full of birds. She wore her blue shawl wrapped around the cage and tied in front to hold it. The willow cage must have been very light because she was not bent over, yet it towered over her head with turrets like a Japanese pagoda. And full of birds, green and yellow, flapping about like dreams trying to escape from a skull. She looked like an angel moving down the rows, following her mistress, looking at no one. The mistress had stopped to haggle with a man and buy another bird. She was so tiny, from the back she also looked like a servant girl. But when she turned, her skirts and silver earrings whirled, and her face was very startling, an Azteca queen with ferocious black eyes. Her hair was braided in a heavy crown, like the Isla Pichol girls, and her posture very regal, though she wore the same ruffled skirts as her maid. She gave the vendor his money and took two green parrots, slipping them neatly into the cage on the girl's back, then moved off quickly toward the street. The old market woman, La Perla, said, "Don't fall in love with that one, guapo. She's taken, and her man carries a gun." "Which one is married, the servant girl or the queen?" La Perla laughed, and so did her friend Cienfuegos, the lizard man. "There's no queen there," she said. "More like a puta," was La Perla's opinion. But Cienfuegos didn't agree. "It's her husband who chases women, not the other way around." The two of them argued about whether the tiny Azteca queen was a harlot. The lizard found and consumed a scrap of tortilla in the street. Finally, Cienfuegos and La Perla agreed on one thing. The regal little woman is married to the discutido pintador, the much-discussed painter. "Who discusses him so much?" Cienfuegos said, "The newspapers." La Perla said, "Everyone, guapo, because he is a communist. Also, the ugliest man you ever saw." Cienfuegos asked how she knew what he looked like. Did he come around courting her? La Perla said she saw him once at the Plaza Caballito, down there with the troublemakers when the workers had their strike. He was as fat as a giant and horribly ugly, with the face of a frog and the teeth of a communist. They say he eats the flesh of young girls, wrapped in a tortilla. "He's a cannibal, and from the look of her, I would say his little bride there might also eat children for lunch." "From the look of things today, they're having parrot stew." "No, guapo," La Perla said, "not to eat. Those birds are for his paintings. He paints pictures of the strangest things. If he gets up in the morning and wants to paint the hat of an Englishman, his wife has to go find him the hat of an Englishman. Small or big, if he wants to paint it, eso, she has to run to the market and buy it." "She must be carrying a lot of money in her purse, then," said Cienfuegos, "because the newspaper says right now he's painting the National Palace." October 6. Mother reached a diplomatic compromise with P.T. Cash. She gets to visit his house in Cuernavaca next week, and maybe some parties. Mother wants to learn the new dances. "The Charleston is for dead hoofers," she says. "Only the meatballs are doing that now. In this city, the smooth girls put on long skirts and do the sandunga and jarabe." Suddenly, the butterfly girls with long skirts and braided hair are in fashion. Mr. Cash does not agree. He says only nationalists and outlaws let their girls do those dances. But Mother bought a phonograph record for practicing the sandunga. Finally, the Victrola is unpacked from its box, finding its outlaw voice. October 15. Mother in Cuernavaca all week with P.T. Cash. She has agreed to the theory that looking for some jobs is better than staying at the school of cretins, because of the oil men's money running over the border like water. None yet except running errands for La Perla, which is work but no job. Trying to hire as a scribe to write letters for people in Plaza Santo Domingo was a bad idea. The men with stalls there howled like monkeys, defending their territories, even though lines are long and people wait all day. For 2 days, the baker downstairs needed help with mixing the dough while his wife was away. But now she is back, and he says, "Run away. We don't need a beggar boy here.
18 October. Mother is back in fine feather with extra hush money. She bought one of the newspapers that carries the long adventure of Pancho Villa. The story is told a little each Saturday, so you'll have to buy another paper. But when people finish, you can pick it up from the sidewalk for free. Yesterday's heroes fall beneath the shoes of the city. On Saturdays, the university students have their carpas in the street, like a Pancho and Judas play, only with Vasconcelos and the president. Vasconcelos is always saving Mexico for the Mexican people. In a country school, he takes down the cross from the wall, routs the nuns, and teaches the peasant children to read. He should come to Avenida Puig. President Ortiz Rubio gets to play more various roles. A puppet of gringos, or a baby in a basket, or a hairless esquinkle dog. Everything but an iguana on a leash. Some newspapers agree with the students that the president is a villain, and others say he saved us from Vasconcelos, the foreigners, and the Russians. The newspapers only agree on the much-discussed painter. He covers the walls of our buildings with colors like a tree produces flowers. One newspaper showed a picture of him. La Perla was right. Ugly! They say he's making a huge painting on the stairwell of the National Palace, the long red building on the Zócalo with windows like holes in a flute. Cienfuegos and La Perla disagree whether you can walk in and have a look. The old lizard man says they have to let you because it's courts and public offices. Tell them you're getting married. La Perla said, stupid old man, that won't work. Where is his wife? All right, Cienfuegos said. Tell them you're getting a divorce.
24 October.
Dios mío! The paintings pull you right up the walls. Cienfuegos was right. They are inside, but you can walk through the main door into the courtyard with a flying horse fountain and a portico all the way around. In all the little offices, men stand in shirt sleeves recording marriages and tax accounts. Outside their doors, on the hallway walls, Mexico bleeds and laughs, telling its whole story. The people in the paintings are larger than the men in the offices. Dark brown women among jungle trees. Men cutting stone, weaving cloth, playing drums, carrying flowers as big as brooms. Quetzalcoatl sits at the center of one mural in his grand green-feathered headdress. Everyone is there. Indians with gold bracelets on brown arms. Porfirio Diaz with his tall white hair and French sword. In one corner sketch, a native esquinkle dog growls at the European sheep and cattle that have just arrived, as if he knows the trouble ahead. Cortez is there too, in the hallway outside property assessment. The painter has made him look like a white-faced monkey in his crested helmet. Moctezuma kneels while the Spaniards make their mischief, fat monks stealing bags of gold, the Indians enslaved. But Cortez was not the beginning of Mexico or its end, as the books say. These paintings say Mexico is an ancient thing that will still go on forever, telling its own story in slabs of color, leaves and fruits and proud naked Indians in a history without shame. Their great city of Tenochtitlan is still here beneath our shoes, and history was always just like today, full of markets and wanting. A beautiful lady lifts her skirt, showing her tattooed ankle. Maybe she is a puta? Or a goddess, or just someone like Mother who needs an admirer.
The painter makes you see that those three kinds of women might all be the same, because all the different ancestors are still inside us and don't really die. Imagine being able to tell such stories, whispering miracles into people's brains, to live by imagination alone and get paid for it. Don Enrique was wrong. Where was the much-discussed painter? The guard said usually he's here day and night, any hour he can get his plaster mixers and pigment tests to show up. Every day, but not today. The mural on the wall behind the grand staircase was enormous and not even half finished. Ladders and platforms covered most of the wall so he could reach the highest parts. The guard looked up there at the planks for a while, as though he expected to find the painter sleeping there. But today, no. "Maybe he shot someone," the guard said. "Come back tomorrow. He has a lot of friends here at the ministry. He always gets out of prison." October 25. Today, the painter came to work. He was already on the scaffolds at 9 o'clock. High up on the planks, hard to see, but plainly he was there because workers swarmed around him like his own hive of bees. The assistant boys were running all over the courtyard with water and plaster, planks and ladders. They mix plaster in buckets and haul it up to him on a rope. "It's not just a painting," these boys explained with proper scorn. "A mural. Hard to say that in English. A wall made. Not wall or painting, but both combined, made at the same time so the picture will never fall off unless the wall itself tumbles. A plaster captain up on the scaffold works continuously at the painter's side, spreading the last thin coat of white paste. Not too quickly or too slow, so the painter can put his pigments in the plaster as it dries. Those two have worked together since God was sucking his mother's tit," the boys said. They seemed more afraid of the plaster captain than the painter, though both men shouted down like God sending commandments, "Too much water in the plaster," or "Not enough." Today, every boy was stupid. The problem was the man in charge of plaster mixing, named Santiago, but today named Mud, because absent. They said he broke his head in a fight over a woman. And according to the painter, without Santiago, none of these boys could mix plaster any better than his grandmother's dog. "I can mix plaster." "Go ahead, then." It was like mixing the flour for pan dulce. How could it be so different? The powder they called cal has the same fine grind, floating up in white clouds around the boys when they dumped bags of it into the mixing buckets. Their eyelashes and the backs of their hands were white, and the edges of their nostrils from breathing it. They were dumping powder into the water, not the other way around. "Wait. Spread a canvas on the floor. Make a mountain of the powder. Pour water in the center, a lake in the volcano. Mix the lagoons with your fingers into marshes, making the paste thick. Gradually, or there will be lumps." Even the old plaster captain up on the platform stopped working to watch. It was terrifying. "Where did you learn that?" "It's like making dough for pan dulce." That caused the plaster boys to laugh. Boys don't make bread. But they were in trouble, so got quiet again. One asked, "Like nixtamal for tortillas?" "No, the white flour dough. You use it for European bread and sweet buns." "Ha, ha, ha, sweet buns. So the new job has a new name to go with it." But the plaster captain and painter both remarked on the plaster. The plaster captain is Señor Alva. The painter is Señor Rivera. He is even more fat than he looked in the newspaper, and feared by the boys, so it might be true he eats flesh. But when he climbed down from the scaffold to go make his water, he said, "Hey, sweet buns, come over here. Let me have a look at the boy who's mixing this good plaster." He said, "Come back tomorrow. We may need you again."
29 October. The painter keeps boys running as late as the last trolley runs. Sometimes you mix or tie ropes or carry things up the scaffolds. The palacio has spiked iron lanterns hanging from the ceiling. You have to watch your head or could crown yourself. The stairwell mural is the size of two walls, one above the other. It is meant to be finished before the end of the year. A coarse plaster full of sand goes on first to cover ridges and bumps in the brick wall. Next, three more layers, each smoother and whiter, more marble dust and less sand. The bumps are erased, like forgetting, and the painter begins the story new. Each day he leaves more history on the wall, and boys leave with more pesos in their pockets. Today, Señor Alva came down from the scaffold as fast as a monkey to fight with one of the guards. They are rude about the paintings. Four boys in Tejano hats came in and said they would throw tar on the wall after the painter goes home to defend Mexico and save her national symbols from insult. Señor Alva shouted at the guards to keep those boys away, but the painter seems not to care what they say. He keeps painting.
10 November. Señor Rivera is gone, and the wall only half painted. Indians and horsemen ride above white air. The mountains have no ground beneath them. The coal sketches on the rough white wall remain half alive, waiting. This can't be the end, but Señor Alva says for sure he's gone. To San Francisco to paint for the gringos. The only work now is to take apart the scaffold and clean the splatters of plaster off the floor. "That's it, boys," he said. "The pesos have gone to San Francisco, too."
18 January, 1931, Feast of San Antonio. The priest did the blessing of animals. The society ladies brought parrots and canaries to church, clutching the cages against brocaded bosoms, baby-speaking to their birds with bird-pursed lips, or holding cats that wriggled violently, hopeful of eating a parrot, or hairless esquinkles that watched with big, disapproving eyes popping out of their dog skulls. At the back of the church, villagers waited with goats and burros on ropes. After dogs and parrots were satisfactorily blessed, the farm women were allowed to lead their beasts down the aisle, all eyes upon the burro blessings dropped on the floor. One old man brought a sack of dirt over his shoulder that was crawling with ants and caterpillars. When he marched to the altar, all the women in smart hats leaned away from the aisle, their long strands of pearls all swaying to one side as if the deck of a ship listed beneath them. The priest, in his clean hems, backed away from the altar as the farmer heaved his sack onto it and black ants swarmed all over. "Go on, make these pests into Christians!" the farmer shouted. "I'll take them home to convert the others so they'll stop chewing on my crops and leave me a living." Cienfuegos came with Manjar Blanco on his leash. The ladies did not know how to pray for a Christian lizard. Their little dogs are probably still barking about it.
31 March. School or a job is the only choice, Mother says. So it's school again, murderous. Today there was a body, draped in black cloth, lying across four wooden chairs lined up side by side in the administrator's office. The administrator was still out having his lunch when the penitent was sent in for a minor infraction involving spittle and had to wait there a long time examining the body. Its feet stuck out from beneath the drape, plainly the feet of a dead person. Man or woman, it was impossible to tell, but nothing was breathing under that cloth. No scent of corpse gas either. Detective novels often mention that, but perhaps it was recently dead and hadn't had time to decay. Or perhaps there was corpse gas, the whole school smelled of piss, and it might be similar. The hour passed horribly, measured in held breaths. 20 minutes. It couldn't be Senora Bartolome under that black drape. Too slim. And not the administrator. Everyone saw him leave for his lunch. What kind of school punishes boys by making them sit in a room with a corpse? 50 minutes. Outside in the sun, the Holy Mother stood on her pedestal in the garden, sorry but unsympathetic, the usual position of mothers. 58 minutes. The administrator returned in a high mood, smelling a little of pulque. At the sight of the penitent, he fell into his chair, abruptly depressed. Lately he can summon little courage for the beatings. Oh, it's Shepherd, our troublesome foreigner. What is it today? Reading in the class again, sir, and participating in a contest of sorts. Of what sort? Of spitting to hit a mark on the floor, sir. Anything that might improve your character? The reading, I mean. No, sir. Booth Tarkington. The administrator leaned so far back in his chair, it appeared he might fall out of it, or else begin a nap. He made no mention of the draped form. Who could it be? It seemed taller than the stunted type of boy inclined to this school, but hard to judge lying down. Sir, is it possible to ask, has any of the teachers been ill? Sitting near enough the body that he could reach over to box its ears, the administrator replied, "All as hale as can be expected for women of their age and temperament." He sighed, which is to say, probably immortal. Why do you ask? One of the students, then? Has any boy turned up, well, dead? The administrator now seemed unlikely to nap. Dead? Perhaps subjected to an overly long punishment by accident and perished? The administrator now sat up. You are an imaginative boy. Are you also a suspicious one? A glance at the feet that poked from under that drape. No, sir. You should write stories, boy. You have the disposition for a romantic novelist. Sir, is that a good or bad disposition to have? The administrator smiled and looked sad both at once. I am not certain, but I'm sure of one thing. You don't belong in this school. No, sir. That seems certain to me also. I've spoken of it to Senora Bartolome. She says your competence at learning the Latin lessons has surpassed her competence to teach them. It isn't fair to the others for her to teach so much. They struggle with conjugating their shoes and stockings. A long pause. We discussed a transfer to the preparatoria next year. Sir, the entrance examinations are murder. At least for anyone who's missed learning everything they teach after the 6th grade primary. Indeed. How did that happen to you? A drastic home life, sir. Something like a novel. Well, then, one can only hope you are writing it all down. No, sir. Only some of it. On the interesting days. On most of the days, it's along the lines of a bad novel with no character learning any moral. The administrator placed his elbows on the desk and touched his fingers together, making his hands into a flower bud. The unanswered question of the corpse still lay beside him. This was more of an interesting day. "Back to the classroom with you, then, young shepherd," he said finally. "I will tell Senora Bartolome that you have my permission to read adventure novels as much as you like, in preparation for your writing career. But I'll advise you to pay attention during the maths. They could turn out more useful than they seem."
"Yes, sir."
"One thing more. We are aware your attendance is casual."
"I had a bit of work, sir, but lost it again."
"Well, I expect there is little I can do about keeping you here. But please come on Friday. Before we dismiss for Easter week, our school will be leading the processional down the street to St. Agnes. We need 6 of our older boys for carrying the Santo Cristo. You may be the only one who can remember which way to walk."
"For carrying the what?"
The administrator leaned out from his desk and yanked the silk drape from the corpse, exposing a bloody head and naked shoulders. "Our crucifixion figure. We've just had it cleaned and varnished, ready to carry into the chapel."
"Oh, indeed, sir. Corpus Deum. He lives."
School is closed for Holy Week, but Mother is in an unholy frame of mind due to the predicted collapse of the Mexican oil industry. According to PT, production has fallen to less than a quarter what it was when the Americans first came in. They thought they were tapping a deeper vein, he said.
"So did I," Mother says.
In a jam, she's asked the doctor's wife for guidance. As usual, it was suggested that God might provide, so Palm Sunday Mass at the cathedral is part of the plan. The place was a forest of palm leaves standing upright, swaying in the windless air, held up by villagers with pleading eyes and hungry children. Mrs. Doctor was dressed up in a silver fox stole like Dolores del Rio. She pulled Mother toward the front pews, away from the odors of poverty. The kneeling lasted hours, but Mother wrestled through. The streets outside afterward were like a festival. People pouring in from the provinces, maybe some even from Isla Pichol. All eyes turn to the Virgin as she is conveyed about town in many different processions, dressed in her jeweled diadem and many new frocks at once. Uninteresting days without number. A National Geographic pinched from the bookshop. It had a photograph of a Hindu with 600 pins inserted in his body. 2 skewers through his abdomen, 1 through the tongue. Dressing each morning takes him 1.5 hours. For overcoming life's catastrophes, he walks through fire. 8 May. The administrator called Mother in for a talk before school ends. She would sooner walk through fire, yet she put on her worst dress and went. The administrator told Mother it was in the boy's interest that he should attend a different school next year. There were choices, technical, professional, but his advice was the preparatoria. He lectured Mother using many conjugations of the verb to prepare. Preparation for preparatoria, but Mother prepares for nothing. She informed him it was none of his business, but her son was going to the United States to live with his father, and she was certain the schools there were of higher caliber. Is it true? On the angry walk home, she refused to say. 10 June. The angel servant girl of the birdcage reappeared at the Melchor Market. This time she was without the birdcage, but again followed hastily behind the Azteca queen, accepting every form of purchase that dark little woman could shove in her arms. Clay bowls, sacks of beans, a devil's head made of papier-mâché. The mistress limped slightly, but otherwise was exactly the same, snapping her fingers at the servant girl and everyone else as she moved down the rows, measuring every object with fearsome black eyes. La Perla recognized them too. "That scandal, the painter's wife," she called her. "They went away, but see, they're back, probably kicked out by the gringos. It will be in the newspapers. The communists always make trouble so they can get in the papers."
24 June, St. John's Day. The lepers bathe again. La Perla was right. The painter is in the newspapers. The president wants him to finish what he started on the Palacio stair wall. All the top-level men want this painter now. Ambassador Morrow hired him to paint his palace in Cuernavaca. Mother claims she saw it when she was there, and the ambassador also, who is now a senator of the United States. She says she spoke to him on the street, and why not? They're acquainted. Ambassador Morrow came to visit Don Enrique. It was the time she made P.T. Cash dance with her in his black and white shoes. Now she thinks Morrow would have been the better bet.